Hi, my name is Mike Treader. I'm the Managing Director at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and I'm here today to do a Blogging Heads interview about earthquakes with Ramon Arrowsmith. Ramon, why don't you tell us about yourself?
Right. I'm delighted to be here. This is exciting for me. And I'm an associate professor at Arizona State University in the School of Earth and Space Exploration. And my area of expertise is the geology of earthquakes, and so I'm interested in basically extending our information about earthquakes into a longer time scale than the human time scale. And I've been in this position. I've been a professor for 15 years, and so over this time I've engaged in a number of different research projects in California, really focusing on the San Andreas Fault System, in Baja California, looking at faults around Cabo San Lucas and La Paz, Mexico, and then also in Central Asia. This is an area of great interest to me, is looking at faults in the former Soviet republics of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, and then I've also had a long-going set of projects in Western China.
Okay, so to kind of start out with the basics, most people probably know this, but let's just cover it quickly anyhow. Tell us, first of all, what makes earthquakes happen? What causes earthquakes?
Right. Well, basically earthquakes are the sudden release of stress that's built up due to the steady motion of the plates of the Earth's surface, in the sense the outer shell that's maybe 10 or 50 kilometers thick. I'm going to use metric system here. And you can think of the plates move, you know, the Earth doesn't get any larger in diameter or smaller with time. And so as these plates move, there are maybe 10 large ones. They either move toward each other, they move apart away from each other, or they move side by side relative to each other. And because we don't create a new volume of the Earth over time, we have to basically destroy plates. In other words, one has to be pushed underneath the other, or if they're moving toward each other, or if we make new plates at the middle of mostly ocean basins to balance that destruction.
Right, and as I understand it, as you say, the plates will get larger, some of them. The edges will expand, and so as you said, somewhere that extra space has to be taken up by, which I believe it's called subduction, where one plate slides underneath another.
That's right. So one thing, if we just back up for 1 second, maybe most people remember the story, or they can think of how Africa and South America basically fit together. So if you close the Atlantic Ocean basin, you can match up the sides of the continents. And likewise, Eastern North America and Europe would match together pretty well. And this was an idea that was put forth in the early 20th century by Alfred Wegener. But at that time, people couldn't figure out how it worked. And so his ideas weren't really well supported, even though there was a lot of evidence for it, not only the matches of the continental edges, but fossil assemblages that showed that the plates must have been much closer together, the continental plates. And so it wasn't until World War II, with the advent of observations of the seafloor, that we began to realize that we could create new oceanic crust that would help basically push the plates apart. And so we learned that the seafloor was, the Atlantic Ocean Basin was widening at over geologic timescales. And so at the same time that the Atlantic Ocean Basin is widening, then the Pacific Basin must close. And so that's mostly the Ring of Fire that we talk about, as a series of locations where pretty much the Pacific plate is being driven underneath other plates. So if you think of the Chile earthquake that we just had recently, that was the consequence of a portion of the Pacific plate being driven underneath the western side of South America, and this subduction zone is continuous throughout all of South America and even into Central America. And then we go around the western North America. Is a little bit more complicated. We can talk about it later. But mm-hmm. You head up around towards Alaska and the Aleutians, and even around Kamchatka and Japan, and those are all subduction systems where the Pacific plate's being driven underneath the plates to the north and west.
So you might say, to put it simply, that the plate on which South America sits, the plate that contains most of South America, essentially is sliding over the top of the Pacific plate, and or at least it's pushing in that direction, and the tension or stress builds up over time, and then there's, as I understand it, a sudden release of that tension, a slip where the plate moves suddenly, and that's what we call, or what results in what we call, an earthquake.
That's right, and I was just reviewing a little bit of the literature for that region that we call the Andean subduction zone, and it is really quite impressive that the Pacific plate there is moving relative to kind of a stable South American plate at in cases 50 to 80 millimeters a year. So this is quite fast. This is, you think your, most people think of their fingernails growing, and everybody's fingernails grow at different rates, but we mostly think that in a year your fingernails might grow about 35 or 40 millimeters, in other words about an inch or a little bit more, but this relative motion is actually much larger than that, and maybe two inches or more. So, and that's just in 1 year. So, but the problem is that interface between the overriding South American plate and the subducting Pacific plate is locked. Just like if you're going to snap your fingers, you load up the stress, and then suddenly, it releases.
So you're saying that my fingernails grow at about the same rate?
I think your fingernails grow a little bit slower. I always say that your fingernails grow at the rate at the San Andreas Fault moves, which is about 35 millimeters a year. So this is almost twice as fast.
All right.
So this is kind of an exercise for the listeners, perhaps, to let's measure our fingernail growth.
But that's still, that's pretty fast. I mean, you're saying it in a year, if I didn't cut my fingernails, they might grow 2 inches.
Yeah.
And for continents to be pushing against or sliding up against each other 2 inches a year, at least I can understand how that could create quite a bit of force if there wasn't any place for it to give.
Yeah, and this, the zone along that interface that's basically from a little bit below the seafloor down to maybe 50 kilometers has just the right conditions where it has enough force perpendicular to kind of lock it up, but it's not hot enough where there's real flow, is the main locked interface. And so that locked interface accumulates stress at this, 2 inches per year rate equivalent. And so then over, 100 years or so, we can accumulate a lot of slip that needs to be released.
Right, because we don't, even though there'll be tiny earthquakes on a regular basis, there won't be a large one like we just had in Chile or Haiti on a regular basis. So all of that stress builds up over decades or centuries until most of it is released essentially all at one time. Is that correct?
Exactly. So just like I'm going back to this analogy of snapping your fingers, you push your fingertips together, but then you also push one relative to the other, and there's initially, you build up stress, your fingers might kind of slightly deform, but then suddenly the strength of that connection is exceeded and snap.
Ah. Okay. Now, after the Chile earthquake occurred, we heard that it was an 8.8 on the Richter scale, and there were comparisons to the Haiti earthquake, which I believe was a 6.7 or 6.8, something like that. Mm-hmm. And immediately the news report started saying, well, Chile was 1,000 times more powerful than Haiti. First of all, is that accurate? How is 8.8 1,000 times more powerful than 6.8? Or is it, or is it not? What does that mean?
Right, I was kind of preparing to talk about this a little bit because I was kind of going to check it myself because if you first, listen and you think, okay, well, magnitude 7, magnitude 8.8, what do these mean? And it turns out that scale is kind of a legacy from early days of seismology when the magnitude of an earthquake was measured by the amplitude of the wiggles on one of these seismograms that we see measured from a kind of a reference location and on a reference machine. And so then, but over time, as our understanding of earthquakes became more modern, we've developed a sort of more accurate way of describing the energy or the magnitude of an earthquake, but we have a kind of a correction to go back to this moment magnitude equivalent. So I don't know if how the listeners or the viewers want to or how they're comfortable with having a few equations here, but I can just try to narrate this a little bit. I don't know. You'll
sure.
have to stop me if it sounds too complicated. But basically, because this I think will make sense, is that what we want to talk about is that the earthquake can be measured in terms of seismic moment, which would be units of Newton meters. So if you remember from your physics class in high school, let's say Newton meters is, you know, it's force times distance. That's basically work.
Mm-hmm.
And so the equation for seismic moment is something called the shear modulus, which we'll talk about in a moment, times the area that fails during the earthquake times the average offset over that surface. So you can imagine, okay, the average offset is that what's released, this accumulated slip that we've talked about that was accumulating at 2 inches per year. And then, so for example, to keep in English units, if it was 100 years that it accumulated, we'd have 200 inches released, right? So that's the slip. And then the area is the along the fault distance times the down fault distance. So just for comparison, what we think the area or the along fault distance in Chile was 600 kilometers. And the downfall distance it's a little bit uncertain, but, 50 to 100 to 150 kilometers. So it was a big area that failed. And the average slip was something like 5-ish meters.
Wow.
So if you think for Chile, then we have this 600 kilometers times 150 kilometers times 5 meters, and then multiply times the shear modulus, which is 30 gigapascals, or 30... times 10 to the 10th newtons per square meter. So again, if you go through the sort of dimensional analysis, going back, doing a little bit of scientific, exponential notation, if you remember from your high school math classes, you end up saying that basically the Chile earthquake was about 2.7 times 10 to the 22nd newton meters of work was released during that earthquake. Okay, so just think of, let's do the order of magnitude. So 10 to the 22nd newton meters. Now, if we go compare that with Haiti, so mm-hmm. the long fault length is about 30 kilometers, so much shorter. It's a vertical fault instead of an inclined fault. So actually, the down dip distance to the kind of cutoff warm temperatures is only about 10 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 30 times 10. So about 300 square kilometers of area failed in Haiti. And then the average slip is actually a little bit high, maybe 3 meters. So we have 30 times 10, each of those is kilometers, have to be converted to meters, times 3 meters, times the shear modulus. Basically, you come up with 10 to the 19th newton meters. So it takes 5 minutes to explain, but yes, it makes sense that it's 1,000 times bigger. At order magnitude scale, if you refine your calculations, you can actually get it to be right around 500 times bigger.
Yeah, that's the figure that I heard after a couple of days, and people were looking at it a bit more closely. Somewhere around 500 times the force.
Yeah.
On the other hand, apparently the location of the Haiti earthquake was almost directly beneath very heavily populated areas. Whereas in Chile, it was somewhat offshore, and so by the time the force of the quake reached the populated areas in Chile, it was actually, it had reduced somewhat from its epicenter. Is that correct?
That's right, and this is what we'd always talk about when we're lecturing about earthquakes. In a simple sense, it's important to differentiate magnitude and intensity.
Right.
So what I just said, all of this, either in Newton meters or as the what we're more familiar with, magnitude 7 or magnitude 8.8, is a fixed measure of energy in the earthquake, so it doesn't change with distance. It's just what the earthquake released.
Right.
Whereas intensity changes with distance, and that's because the seismic waves spread out and they lose energy with distance. And they also interact with the local geologic structure. So in a few cases, they can be amplified by sedimentary basins, but in general, with distance, they decrease. So So you're right. The Haiti being kind of right underneath, right adjacent to Port-au-Prince is significant in terms of proximity relative to the more kind of distant Chilean earthquake position, especially relative to the population centers.
And I think the other important difference between the two areas is how well prepared they were, how the building codes were set up, how well building codes had been enforced, how stable the governments were and the economies, et cetera. To me, the huge difference in destruction and fatalities, you know, something like a 500 or 1,000 times difference there, was not proportional. Obviously, it was inversely proportional to the strength of the quake. It was a stronger quake in Chile, but far, far greater amounts of death and suffering in Haiti. But that wasn't because of the earthquake. That was because of sort of human society and our inability to adequately prepare in one area. Whereas in Chile, they experience earthquakes frequently, and so they were better prepared for that.
That's right, and I have a couple of maybe I have a quote on that I want to find here real quick. But the people have talked about that really the it was really about preparation and kind of the social and cultural kind of conditions and also it's a kind of a matter of people's memories where Chileans are used to earthquakes. You know, there's. Yeah. There have been many large earthquakes in that region, although mostly, again, kind of far enough away that they shake the ground, and you know, people get scared a little bit, or there are fatalities and damage, but in general, it's not catastrophic. But they're reminded, at least on the decadal timescale, about earthquakes in Chile, and they have their society and their economy is such that they can afford to have good earthquake preparedness in terms of building construction and also to enforce it.
Right. Yeah, or similar comparisons can be made between, for example, Japan, where they frequently have severe earthquakes. They as you say, they remember them, and so they prepare for them. Plus, economically and politically, they're more stable, and they have the money to build buildings properly and so forth. Whereas if you take a country like Afghanistan, where earthquakes are not very frequent and the politics and the economics are very poor, when they did get struck by a major earthquake a few years ago, it was really devastating.
Absolutely. Yeah, and just one thing I came across that was so impressive to me about the Haiti earthquake was... you know, usually, right, the scientific and engineering communities take the opportunity to learn from earthquakes. And so one thing that always happens is that earthquake engineers are quickly dispatched to earthquake epicentral regions to study the building response. So one thing I saw was a report from UC Berkeley Earthquake Engineering seminar, basically, and it was a preliminary reconnaissance presentation about the Haiti earthquake that was made by this man, Eduardo Fierro, from BFP Engineers. And it's an amazing presentation that they have on, it's on YouTube, people can Google it, but he showed like 400 slides in his PowerPoint in about an hour and a half, and it was very satisfying because of his clear confidence and experience. But he comes along to a certain point about 29 minutes into the presentation, and he had just showed a couple of slides very quickly that had some people who were still dead and lying in the street, and he went past them quickly, and this is after he had been talking about a lot of building damage, and the quote that I transcribed was, he says, "The tragedy of this thing, you know, was that 3 days after the earthquake, the city was littered with bodies, and by God, this was not an earthquake disaster. This was a disaster caused by the construction industry in Haiti. The construction industry that did not know how to use codes, they did not have any codes, and the people that built these things, the buildings were in very bad shape. These were the people that caused this tragedy and the loss of human life. In the past, I, so he's an earthquake engineer, have told people when I give talks, we have to design things and construct things and assume that our children, our grandchildren, and our mother is going to be in this building when the earthquake hits. So we check all our numbers and we do a proper design. So this is pretty strong, you know, but he was really affected by having been there. And this is something now that maybe moves a little bit to some areas of expertise that you have and that other people have is, you know, is that a fair kind of statement in the terms of, you know, can we expect that Haitians should have been able to implement obvious earthquake engineering standards?
Right. Yeah, they're really important ethical questions, which is an interesting sort of overlap here between the science and the ethics. And to me, part of that overlap is technology and economy. You know, we tend to think of technology as connected with science, as objective, as dispassionate. And yet, whether technology is implemented and whether it's implemented effectively depends to a large extent on the ethics that are applied in a situation, economically, you know, in terms of equality and equal opportunity. That's what makes this so interesting. And I think as you were giving that quote from the other geologist, it made me think that there's a difference between a natural disaster and a human disaster. Obviously, whenever human lives are lost, it's a disaster. But the scale of the human disaster in Chile was tiny compared to the disaster in Haiti. Even though that on a natural disaster scale they were relatively equivalent. In fact, Chile was stronger, but yeah. The human toll was so much greater in Haiti, and that can be blamed much less on nature and much more on human choices.
Exactly. And it's so the other point, just to develop that, is there's another really interesting and active set of commentary that's being led by people like Roger Billum from University of Colorado, and he's on the news. Maybe some people hear of him, but he recently wrote a paper that was called The Seismic Future of Cities. And it's in the Bulletin of Earthquake Engineering. And he basically makes the point that, you know, basically the final projected sort of doubling of Earth's population next half century is just going to push so many more people into so much greater harm's way. And the problem is that, well, and so there's a number of things. One is just the kind of integrated effect of many more moderate-sized cities becoming, you know, moderate, sort of changing its definition from, you know, a village-type size of thousands of people to hundreds of thousands, and, you know, the direct hit on those sized cities is going to become much more common. And somebody made a quote once that, you know, there are cities in Indonesia that are in direct sort of line of a tsunami hit that many of us have never even heard the names of.
Sure. Yeah.
And then, but the real other issue that Roger brings up is the sort of mega city or super city where you have, you know, urban agglomerations of larger than 10 million people. And so, you know, if you have an epicentral hit on one of these great, you know, super cities, and if the proper sort of thinking isn't employed with respect to managing the growth and the construction, you know, you could have even larger numbers of fatalities than happened in Haiti, you know, like he quotes a million.
Right. Well, let's, and unfortunately that is becoming more and more conceivable. Let's go to two really important questions that I'm sure people are thinking of. The first one is, why can't we predict earthquakes? So we keep hearing in China that, at least on one occasion that I've read about, that a sizable earthquake was predicted in advance, but unfortunately it seems like most often we can't. And with all of our, you know, learning and science, why aren't we yet able to effectively predict when an earthquake might happen?
Well, it is a pity that we can't predict, and we even most times people have the term earthquake prediction has kind of fallen into somewhat of lower popularity, and practically what a lot of times we say is forecasting, which means you kind of allow for somewhat greater ambiguity in terms of the location and the timing, but we have and we explain everything in probabilities, and so we might be able to say in California, you know, there's a 60% chance of a magnitude 7 or greater earthquake occurring in the next 30 years in, let's say, in the San Francisco Bay Area or something like that. And that's something we could say with great confidence, and our confidence is even quantified, in other words, by having it cast in probabilities. And right. and that largely, that is an activity that's going on and is done especially well in the developed world, in you know the U.S. and in Japan, for example, and builds on our understanding of the geology and the active deformation that we can measure. So, and it's of great interest to the reinsurance industry. So you know it's if you're a big insurance company, you might look at things from a kind of arm's length and say, well, how can we distribute our risk at with this kind of longer spatial and temporal view? So forecasting can be quite valuable for them. But turning to prediction, the problem is that the Earth is a complex system, and we don't, even though we understand to a pretty good degree the underlying physics that drive earthquakes, we still can't use that physics to practically predict the timing of earthquakes, but we're working on it. And then the other thing is we're also looking at precursory activity. So, you know, for example, in the case of the Chinese earthquake that was supposedly predicted, you know, it was probably the case that it was a kind of an earthquake that had many foreshocks.
Right.
And they were small enough that you know people don't notice them, but your cat is sitting there thinking, why am I shaking? And and so then animals became right. agitated, and so the Chinese officials kind of paid attention, and it worked. But the sad thing is, it wasn't long after that there was another big
yes.
earthquake in China that was not predicted, and
right.
many people died.
Well, are you saying that was a lucky guess, or that particular kind of earthquake was unfortunately sort of rare, was one that could be predicted?
I would say, strictly speaking, it was a lucky guess, but they were paying attention, and
right.
The sort of watching of foreshocks, as you know, if you sort of have to know after the fact if it's a foreshock, that means it preceded a main shock, but
right.
you know, basically looking at seismicity patterns is an active area of earthquake prediction, and go ahead. You were going to say something.
Well, what I was going to say is how long will it take until we can say with a fairly high degree of certainty, instead of being able to say within the next 30 years, we can forecast that there is a 90% probability of a 7.5 magnitude quake in the California San Francisco Bay Area. We can say that now and be pretty confident in our forecast, but how long will it be until we can say within the next 2 weeks there will be a magnitude 7.5 or between 7.2 and 7.8 earthquake centered around the San Francisco Bay Area? It seems to me obviously that would be much more helpful in the long run. But is it ever going to be possible to do that? If we had enough money and enough effort put into it, could that be done at some point in the near future?
I think so. I think it's it's an area that we, all of us who study earthquakes, are really kind of concerned about. And there's some steps in the right direction which have occurred in the last few years. And one thing is this activity called the collaboratory for the it's called CSEP.org, and now I forgot the name of it. CSEP.org. It's an activity that basically coordinates the testing of earthquake predictions, and it It.
I bet the S is seismic.
Yeah, that's so funny. It's terrible that I can't remember it. I thought it was csep.org, but now I'm getting a different thing here.
Well,
but anyway,
scientific earthquake prediction. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, it's something like that. I'm embarrassed that I can't say it, but I don't want to waste time. Right. But anyway, it's a very legitimate activity hosted by the Southern California Earthquake Center and funded by, you know, U.S. National Science Foundation, U.S. Geological Survey, and the Keck Foundation. And it's also got regional centers in Japan, New Zealand, Europe. And the idea is that, you know, there are a lot of algorithms out there for earthquake prediction. And some of them have been scientifically tested, and some of them are, you know, less scientifically tested. The first goal of this activity is to put all these earthquakes basically in a environment in which they can be rigorously tested, and that means really saying, okay, there's going to be an earthquake in this box spatially and in this time temporally, and it's going to have, you know, these characteristics or this magnitude. And so that's the first step, is to basically start to ferret out which are the, you know, reliable predictors and which ones are not. And then anybody, it's also kind of an even playing field. Anybody who can get their predictor to speak the same language in terms of you know, being sufficiently specific can throw in. And so I think that we will start to see that, especially in some regions which have, you know, more well-behaved seismicity, if you want to call it that, that some of those prediction algorithms will start to become more and more reliable and could begin to, you know, the language that people have started to move toward is called operational earthquake forecasting, which is kind of basically moving closer to starting to say prediction, but it's not quite there. And that means, you know, employing these kinds of methods and employing everything we know about earthquakes. So, you know, one of the ways that this can be used as an example comes from remember there was an earthquake in Italy, I think it was last summer, maybe a year and a half ago, the L'Aquila earthquake. And that part of the Italian Apennine is a place where it's very seismically vigorous. And so, you know, there was a main shock in that earthquake, which was damaging. But there were many earthquakes before it that were almost similar in magnitude as foreshocks. They were 5.5s, and then the main shock was maybe a 6. And then there were many aftershocks, which were also 5s. And so this was really an earthquake sequence. And so we can do reasonably well at operational forecasting of basically looking at the last, you know, 24 hours or so and sort of using that to predict the next 24. And that was a place where it started to be used in a practical sense to guide the emergency responders in Italy as they try to deal with the recovery. And then in general, you know, we use our understanding of aftershocks to help guide emergency responders and, in a sense, make predictions that after a main shock, we expect there will be aftershocks and they will decay at a certain, pretty well-established rate.
I want to change gears a little bit here and ask you the other sort of big question, especially that people who are interested in the long future of science and technology might wonder, at some point in the future, will it be possible, in your view, to prevent earthquakes, or at least to relieve the stresses somehow through, you know, science and technology? Is there a way that we could actually conceivably prevent earthquakes or make them smaller than they otherwise would be?
That's a really good question, and I think it's going to be a long time till we could, you know, practically do much in terms of direct intervention with earthquakes. And, you know, a couple examples. First, you can remember, I think it was one of the Superman movies where, you know, wasn't Lex Luthor going to fire a nuclear bomb into a major fault system and cause lots of damage? And in a way, that's one way to think of it, is you need to basically get into the fault zone and decrease the strength of the fault surface on part of it so that you can allow it to slide in a more controlled manner. But, you know, it does literally would take something like with the energy of a nuclear weapon to kind of match up with the energy that's basically stored in even a modern earthquake. You know, I think the I don't have it at my fingertips, but the largest nuclear detonation, you know, sort of megaton scale, is still sitting at around a magnitude 5 in energy release. So,
right.
you know, these big earthquakes are just so much more energy in them than kind of anything we can harness
right.
at the moment. So
you're talking thousands of times, if not millions of times, more energy.
Yeah, and that's a nuclear explosion, which
right.
is not very easily controlled in a way that you probably need to directly interact with a fault surface. So
right.
I think it's tricky. So really our what we need to do is to, you know, continuously monitor. We can definitely move towards a point of really knowing what the Earth is doing at a pretty high level of detail. And an example comes from Japan. You know, after the 1995 Kobe earthquake, which really was devastating, got their attention, the Japanese government invested heavily in earthquake studies, including establishing a GPS network, so a network to measure the motion of Japan's islands at very high resolution, something like 2,000 stations.
Hmm.
And so you can really see Japan deforming at this millimeter per year time scale. And then also they established a very high quality seismic network that also lets them see small earthquakes and see even sort of events that are kind of almost like earthquakes in terms, but not as rapid of slip.
So if we can't, obviously we can't really prevent earthquakes within the next few centuries, very likely. And we're getting a little bit better at forecasting, but we may not be able to say with a high degree of certainty that an earthquake is expected within 2 weeks, let's say, for a while yet. What, though, can be done right now in order to keep earthquake damage and fatalities to a minimum? What are these areas doing that are prone to heavy earthquakes?
Well, I think,
or what should they be doing?
I think there's a few things. You know, that there's a bunch of really easy and practical things that can be done kind of at the almost grassroots level, sort of at the individual level, and that's just basically improving people's understanding of what is an earthquake and then and what to expect and then how to kind of be safe, and in other words, you know, protecting your family and then also protecting your possessions and the structures, you know. So, and there's a lot of great examples out there of even this man I referenced, Eduardo Fierro. He was talking about Peru has a great set of kind of almost comic books that they hand out to construction people who are building buildings, but they have kind of simple guidelines for construction that is accounting for what we know about earthquake safety. For construction. And then the other one is just basically educating people, you know, for like example, tsunamis. You know, if you see the water moving out or you hear about the potential for a tsunami, just go to higher ground. It's pretty simple. So there's a kind of, at the individual level, there's a lot of increase in education that has to be done. And then I think at the economic level, you know, I think that as more, you know, as this population grows, there's also greater appreciation for the economic effects of earthquakes, and that, you know, economies drive to some extent community behavior, and so there is some value in sort of investing in building more earthquake resilient societies.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course there's you know, the responsibility of governments to try to coordinate this and to, you know, provide this high-level guidance in terms of what to do and where to watch out for, you know, all natural disasters. And so that's the other thing, is continued scientific characterization of earthquake zones and related potential hazards, and then also continued support of scientific activities to understand the underlying processes.
Now, we know about California being earthquake prone. You know, that's commonly known, well known. Japan, the same thing. The Pacific shore of South America is part of the Ring of Fire. There's Alaska, and so on. What areas, though, of the Earth are in your opinion, susceptible to a major earthquake, but they don't happen very often? I mean, are there particular areas that where a surprise might occur that wouldn't really be a surprise to seismologists, but could cause significant damage in an area where you wouldn't expect an earthquake to occur?
Yeah, there's a number of examples, but a couple come to mind. The first one is, you know, and this is one that people talk about occasionally, is Tehran, you know, which is a great city of Iran, sits on top of a number of big active faults that are kind of like the active faults we know are underneath Los Angeles. And so that's a case of a mega city that's threatened, I think, by earthquake potential. But probably the greatest earthquake potential for a place that's quite vulnerable is the Himalayan front in India and Pakistan. So remember, there was an earthquake in 2005 that was in Pakistan, and it was quite devastating, but it was actually relatively small compared to what we know has happened before along the Himalayan front. So, you know, we talked about subduction, and usually subduction is oceanic crust, which is more dense going underneath continental crust. But the Himalayas are basically pushed up as a consequence of India, one continental plate being driven underneath Eurasia, another continental plate. And so this collision is the grand collision of plate tectonics on the Earth right now. And that interface, basically India going underneath Eurasia, is a huge subduction interface with 20 millimeters per year of slip, and so strain accumulation. So, and there's a big historic record that is mostly pre-20th century of great earthquakes there. And so this is one where, you know, there's high population density. There are many huge dams that are in the kind of lower elevation parts of the Himalaya, and that whole interface should fail. You know, over geologic timescales, we know it does.
Wow, I hadn't heard about that one before. That could be really, really catastrophic, of course.
Right. So it's easy to forecast, but hard to predict.
Right. Good point. All right. So I guess I kind of have one last question before we wrap up, and that is, as far as we know, at least in historic time, the largest magnitude earthquake on the old Richter scale, I believe, is in the mid-9s somewhere, 9.5, something like that.
Yep.
Is it possible? What's the largest possible earthquake? Is it conceivable that something could be over a 10 on the Richter scale?
No, I don't think so. You know, really, remember when we went back to our little lecture on earthquake magnitude and how important the area part of the equation is. So really, what's controlling a lot of the magnitude is area. So the problem is, once you get much bigger than a 9.5, you run out of area. There's just not that much fault surface to fail. You know, and it's probably, I haven't done it, but, you know, you could... simple thing would be to compute the cross-sectional area of the Earth, and that's kind of like, well, how big of an earthquake would it take to crack the Earth in half, even though, of course, it would, you know, be physically unrealistic. Right. But you know, that would be larger than 10, but in terms of the thickness of the lithosphere or the crust where we have to contain these earthquakes, we just don't have enough area. So I would think that those 9.5s, you know, which was the prior Chile earthquake of 1960, and then, you know, 9.2, 9.4, which was something like a 64 Alaska earthquake, and then the 2004 Sumatra earthquake, that's about as big as you can get.
Okay. So the other ones are good for disaster movies, but probably not going to happen in real life.
That's right.
All right. Is there anything else besides plate tectonics that causes earthquakes?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of interesting things. Of course, volcanoes cause earthquakes by, you know, simply by the deformation that the moving magma induces on the volume of rock around it. And then also, you know, we can study volcanoes by the seismic waves that they make, and they tend to be kind of rich in their behavior. You know, you can kind of almost hear them breathing, you know, and as the gas and magma flows through conduit. So there's a rich seismic behavior associated with volcanoes, both strictly and less strictly earthquakes. Some landslides can be so big that the landslide and moving so fast that it effectively makes an earthquake. human-induced human activities can make earthquakes. They're just like regular earthquakes, but usually smaller. But we see, you know, a lot of times in places with water injection. You know, there was a news story maybe last year about a geothermal project in Switzerland that had to be halted because there were earthquakes that were triggered by the water injection.
Huh.
And there was a whole issue that came up, which was quite interesting, about the culpability. You know, was the company running the geothermal plant, you know, guilty of causing the earthquake?
Right.
You know, and sort of like, did they know they were going to do it? And then other cases of, you know, around dams sometimes, when we fill up a dam, you know, you both increase the weight, just the weight of the water will potentially sort of increase that stress along fault surfaces. But also as you increase the pore pressure or the water pressure at depth, you push the fault surfaces apart, and that can cause earthquakes. Hmm. So
interesting.
So there's a number of different kinds of things that can drive earthquakes, but usually only plate tectonics will drive the biggest ones.
The ones that are likely to do the greatest damage.
Yeah.
Right, okay. All right, so I think we're ready to conclude. Let me just ask, though, is there anything else you wanted to say or something I didn't ask you about that you think people should know?
Well, I think I've said plenty. I mean, there's a lot more to say. I think, you know, there's a couple of books that have come out recently that people might find interesting. And the author, one of the authors is Huff. It's H-O-U-G-H. And very readable. One of them is about predicting earthquakes and kind of history of that activity. And then there's another one that's about living on uncertain earth or something like that. It's foolish of me not to have the title at my fingertips, but that's another book by Billum and Huff. So a couple books, is, you know, others that could be suggested, but those are good.
Okay.
I guess I was curious just to hear, you know, I wanted to get a little bit more from you, Mike, about this whole ethical thing, you know, and how, you know, how to proceed, you know, because certainly as a scientist, I have to stop talking after I've delivered the, you know, information that I know about how earthquakes work and where they occur, and there's some kind of a handoff that has to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you see, you know, I know a lot about earthquakes. Scientists, we know, and I feel like we're doing a good job. As always, you know, more funding would help. You know, how do we then go the next step? And from your perspective, from where you stand, kind of sitting on top of technology and ethical questions, you know, what are, you know, are there some innovations out there that you might see on the horizon that might help us do a better job? Or, you know, are we going to sort of still be having the same conversations, you know, 10 years from now about the next big earthquakes?
Well, unfortunately, we probably are going to be having those same conversations. We can hope that ability to forecast large quakes will improve. But it really comes down to pretty simple points about being adequately prepared in areas that are known to be susceptible to earthquakes, or for that matter, to other natural disasters. The problem is, of course, that it's less a scientific issue than it is a human issue. It involves politics and economics, and that's where things get complicated and messy, humans being what they are. So, as from a perspective of talking about the ethics involved, what we try to do is encourage people who are in a position to make a difference to apply a combination of scientific knowledge and ethical approaches, to realize that we do have knowledge that can be applied to significantly reduce both structural damage and human fatalities and suffering in the event of natural disasters. But that only works if you know, adequate preparation takes place beforehand. And, of course, you can't do that if you don't have stable political conditions and relatively strong economies. So, unfortunately, just as trying to understand the Earth and its geology is very complex and difficult, you can kind of look at human society as equally complex and difficult to understand or to manage. There are no simple answers, and it's just a matter of continuing to remind people that little things make a difference. To me, one of the greatest lessons that we could learn from the comparison of Haiti and Chile is how something very basic like reinforced concrete versus the concrete block or even adobe mud structures in Haiti makes a really, really big difference. If building codes are set up properly and then are properly enforced, you can save not just tens or hundreds, but thousands and thousands of lives. And you pay a little bit of extra money, you apply a little bit of extra work in the beginning, but in the long run, you save much more money, and certainly you save lives, which is the most important thing of all.
Yes. Yeah, I appreciate that, and I was just looking at one thing that, as I was kind of preparing for today's discussion, I looked, I've been monitoring things out there on the web, and there's a nice kind of opinion item that went to CNN, and it was published on February 28th by Colin Stark, who's a colleague of mine from Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory of Columbia, and he basically, it's a kind of a very well-written sort of musing on the whole problem of, so why did the smaller earthquake kill so many more people? And why the spate of these earthquakes? And then his next sentence was is kind of strong. He says, no, the apocalypse is not coming. No. No, the two earthquakes are not linked in any way, and no, Pat Robertson, you can't blame the devil or the French. The real answers for those comfortable with science and the Enlightenment are tectonics and poverty.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, and I think as a kind of a closing point, we can say that natural disasters will continue to occur, whether they are earthquakes or hurricanes or tornadoes.
Or volcanic eruptions.
Volcanic eruptions, right. Natural disasters are part of life, part of the Earth. Human disasters, on the other hand, can be significantly reduced, if not avoided altogether. But that's a matter of choices that we make. We can't control the Earth yet, and for the foreseeable future we won't be able to. But we can control the choices that we make, and if we can only recognize the long-term implications for the choices we make, it really could make a huge difference in saving lives and preventing suffering.
That's right.
All right, well, this has been really interesting, and I appreciate your taking the time. I know you're traveling and had to make special arrangements for this, but it's important for us to learn as much as we can, especially in light of what's just happened in Haiti and in Chile. And I appreciate your taking the time and educating me and all of the viewers at the same time.
Great. Well, I really appreciate you guiding our conversation and helping me inaugurate my first Blogging Heads activity. I hope the first and not the last.
Great.
It's been a real pleasure. This is a very interesting topic for me, and it's important to try to share these thoughts and sort of get a dialogue going about these topics with the broader community.
Good. Okay, good. And we will put a link up to more information about the work that you're doing and the books that you mentioned as well on the Blogging Heads site.
Right.
Okay, we'll try not to shake too much.
Thank you very much.
All right, Mo. Take care.
You
Bye-bye.
Too.